I did forget one announcement that I was going to make earlier. There's not a Bible study this Wednesday. We had the Bible study on this text that was just read to us by Paul so beautifully this last Wednesday. But this Wednesday, we're just having Holden Evening Prayer at Peace Lutheran at 7. So if you're interested in that, 7 p.m., Holden Evening Prayer. Now, I'm going to... I'll throw in some details from this story that you just heard, but this reflection is meant to stand alongside this amazing reading from John 11. It's not an explanation, if you like, but a further meditation. And as meditations go, of course, it's personal. Hopefully there will be something in it for you. Hopefully the Holy Spirit will open something for you in it. The famous Christian apologist C.S. Lewis wrote a book in 1940 called The Problem of Pain. Anybody here read that book? Yes, a few people. From that book, the most famous quote is probably this one: God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Hi, sweetie. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? There's definitely truth in it. Indeed, it often takes a catastrophe to wake up a community, the world, a nation, to the dangers it should have been aware of long ago. But like other things he wrote in that book, I find what C.S. Lewis says there just a little bit too formulaic, a little too neat and tidy. Nearly two decades after he wrote The Problem of Pain, he penned another book, which I think is a classic, A Grief Observed, in which he described the process of grieving his wife of only a few years, Joy Davidman, a love that had surprised both of them and caught them up in joy later on in life when they weren't expecting it, and then had it ended all too quickly in death. In that book, he said what so many people feel in the midst of grief. Not a new clarity in listening to God's voice because of pain, but something like the opposite, the shattering force of pain. Writing about his bereavement, he said, "When your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting from the inside. After that, silence." He added this: "Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourselves no longer." Today's story, which is often, or at least a smaller part of it, read at Christian funerals as a bright ray of gospel hope, finds, I think, at least, an equal reception alongside of Lewis's lament. Or, as happens every 3 years in our lectionary cycle, as a reflection during Lent. If we can impose on the text a feeling of bereavement, of the shattering power of pain, certainly not a renewed sense of clarity with regards to God's voice, we're much better able to follow the uncomprehending dialogue between the sisters and Jesus, between the disciples and Jesus, and the strange actions, or should we say non-actions, that Jesus engages in at the beginning of the story. I think it's grief That explains Thomas's sorrowful and exasperated, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." By which I take him to mean die with Lazarus, probably a very good friend, and also die with Jesus. Since on top of doing nothing to prevent Lazarus's death, Jesus now seems bound and determined to make everything even worse by taking himself and them into the very teeth of the opposition, to the very place and people that tried to have him killed last time he was around. Now, if you're in a foreign country and you're mugged, I know some people who've had this experience. And then when you file a police report in that foreign country, instead of the muggers getting arrested, you're jailed instead for supposedly disturbing the peace. You're not going to turn around, at least I don't think so, and plan your next vacation in that very country again, are you? Anybody? Not me. I mentioned incomprehension. There's not one piece of dialogue between Jesus and the sisters, or Jesus and the disciples, that achieves understanding or clarity in this story. Go back and look at all of them. It's all just confusion. They don't get what he's getting at. Even when, near the end, Martha says, "I believe you are the Messiah," she doesn't fully, at least, understand what she's saying. She's not, in other words, saying yes to the shocking words that Jesus has just uttered about being the resurrection and the life. Now, let me clarify. She is saying yes to something that will one day, she believes, happen. The righteous dead will be raised to life everlasting. But that's going to happen at the end of time, whenever that is. She has not a clue that Jesus is claiming this reality as a now thing. Something unfolding in the midst of her personal disaster. Now, strangely then, this story, I don't find as some sort of straightforward piece of good news, but rather a deeply unsettling, difficult to understand set of claims in which we sense that consolation is meant for all of us who are listening. But the actual content of that consolation is difficult to get at first blush. Now, if I might be so insensitive to even suggest that the miracle itself, the raising of Lazarus, though on one level, of course, altogether wonderful, has another side to it. Lazarus, of course, is around for a few more years for his sister. Lazarus is able to help provide for their needs and continue to be their friend, etc. But on another level, the raising, the resuscitation of Lazarus doesn't actually solve things for Lazarus in the long term, does it? He has to go through all of it again, the dying, that is. It's bad enough to have to die once. He has to die twice. In the mid-19th century, Robert Browning wrote a poem about this, about what it might be like to live after you've been resuscitated from the dead, and he's referring specifically to Lazarus. It's a very interesting poem. And he's got one line of the poem says, "But flinging, so to speak, life's gates too wide." In Browning's imagination, or imagining, Lazarus has been restored to his sisters, but he's not the same soul now. And as such, it's like he's been to a different planet and can't recover the rhythms of earthly life. You may totally disagree with me, and I'd be fine with that, but I find the story poignant. Poignant, not in the modern usage of that word, which has come to mean relevant for some reason, but in its original meaning, to prick or to sting, to arouse deep emotion, especially pity or sorrow. I do think that John wants to console us, but he wants to console each of us and the original hearers deeply. And to do that, he must first prick or sting. If we don't feel some of the pain in this scene, we won't be ready to understand how truly wonderful parts of the story are. The parts of the story meant to change us, indeed meant to change everything. If we're to live into what Jesus says when he says, "I am resurrection and life, those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" We need to understand that he says that through tears. Just after Jesus says this, these amazing words, he's taken to the tomb, and the text says that he is greatly disturbed. The Greek word evokes deep anger, frustration, pain. An anger that is, or a feeling that is so intense that he breaks down and begins to weep. To weep. Even as Christ gives us the most amazing promise and invitation, he holds our sorrow close. Even as he prays with confidence that God hears him, we remember that this is the same Jesus who will say, my God, why have you forsaken me?" In other words, he too will experience the door bolting and double bolting from the inside, and then silence. When with Martha, we answer Jesus' question, "Do you believe this?" with our own, "Yes, I believe." We're not saying we believe in some panacea, in some quick escape from the ambiguity, the sorrow, and the raw grief of death. Rather, we're saying something like, "I'm with you. I'm with him." I might not understand, indeed I know I don't understand as much as I need to, but rather I trust that you, Jesus, are God's promise to this world and to us, to me, so that even when the door is shut and all I can do is grieve, you get it. And you're going to do something about it, even if it's not on my watch. Notice how when Martha says, "I'm with you, I'm in," to Jesus. To Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life." She's not imagining that Jesus is going to raise Lazarus. She warns him not to go to the tomb, not to roll the stone away. She's not stupid. She knows how this stuff works. I don't know about you, but that's encouraging for me. We're part of a church that is often as hesitant, maybe even more so, than Martha around Jesus' promises. It's encouraging to me because I see Martha committing to Christ in the midst of her confusion with his teaching and his actions, or lack thereof. Commitment to Christ is at the heart of these words, "I believe." Not everything is going to work out in a way that I understand or in a way that makes my life more comfortable. It is this type of commitment that prepares us for both the shattering pain of our own grief observed, for living in a world that is not yet freed from death, but also for the surprise of resurrection and life in the midst of death, in the midst of conditions that don't seem at all that promising. You listen to that first reading? Dry bones. Not a lot of promise there. Not a lot of promise for the national life of Israel. And yet, what is it? 2,500 years later, Jews, Israel, still here. The central claim of this story is that Jesus is the resurrection and the life now, in this day, at this time. At just that particular point where you're asking God, maybe even begging God, and nothing seems to be happening. Do you believe this? Can you commit to being with him, to muddling through with him, and then surprisingly to be open to his power? We notice that Christ is not what he is, even today, on his own, but with us. A participant at our Bible study on Wednesday noticed this. We have a part to play when new life emerges in us, in our families, in our friends, or our faith community, when we least expect it. What does Jesus say? Unbind him. He says to the stunned onlookers after Lazarus has responded to Jesus' shout of life, unbind him. He gets them involved. He gets them not used to, but participating in resurrection and life. And so Jesus is in all our nows, weeping and shouting, whispering, and simply being the life we long for, the life we are called to enable with his help. Amen.